We're back with more of Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. While some might have dreams of breaking earth-shaking news at a magazine like The New Yorker, Mary Norris's aspirations were different. Norris initially wanted to be a writer at the iconic literary news and culture magazine.
But her first job there was in the archives, and it was from there that she saw, across the office, her dream job, on the copy desk, a place where she has remained ever since. But she's also now a published author with a new book about her specialty. It's called Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen. Speaking in front of an audience at Boswell Book Company, Norris explained that she cut her teeth in the little-appreciated department called collating.
In that department, in collating, your job was to take the changes from other proofs, from a fact checker, the editor, the author, and the proofreaders, and collate them onto a single proof for the printer. And that's where I saw how it was done. That's where I saw what the proofreaders did, what they changed, what the fact checkers did. Even before then, I knew I wanted to be on the copy desk. And I tried, when there was an opening on the copy desk, I applied for it by saying that, I had no experience, but that would be an advantage in a place with an idiosyncratic tradition like The New Yorker had. So I did not get the job at that point. But after a year, I moved from collating to the copy desk. And I think it was a job I was suited for because I always loved to read. And I always had an eye for detail in what I read. I liked even seeing the way the columns ended. The column had a margin on one side. I watched for things like division of words and spelling and punctuation. And I think I learned a lot about that stuff just from osmosis, just from being interested in and watching and being an acute reader.
And one of the things that you talk about in the first part of Between You and Me is going to the library and actually doing more, looking at dictionaries, seeing how things, the etymology of things, but also style guides as well.
Well, one of the things that I did for the book was to go to the home of Noah Webster. We have this hierarchy of dictionaries at The New Yorker. We use the most recent edition of Merriam-Webster's Collegiate Dictionary. Now it's 11th edition. And then we, if it's not in there, of all things, we go back to Web 2, the second international dictionary of the American language, unabridged, which was published in, I don't, maybe not have the date exactly right, but something like 1938. In other words, it was pre-atomic age. So that's what we consult. And if it's not in there, we go to Webster's Third, which is the dictionary that caused a great ruckus in the 1960s for including ain't, supposedly, but Web 2 had also had ain't in it, but mostly for not supplying information about whether something was vulgar usage, just leaving people on their own. So we have these. We also have the Random House Second Unabridged, and I like that. And of course, there's also the online dictionary now, which a lot of the younger people in the office use, and which I am finally learning to rely on myself as probably the best single resource. So I got curious about Noah Webster and went and visited his birthplace in West Hartford, Connecticut, and learned that he was the same generation as the patriots of the American Revolution. And the role he wanted to play as a patriot was to rebel linguistically against the King's English, to make spelling American and for Americans to have their own written traditions to compete with the English.
One of the things The New Yorker does, of course, it publishes American authors, but it also publishes British authors, too. How do you mix that? If you're going by an American standard, mm-hmm. how do you accommodate?
Well, that's an interesting question because we are an American magazine and we do publish a lot of British writers, English writers. We publish a lot of things in translation from other languages as well, and we just have our way with that stuff. But the British writers are a little touchy because some of the words they use and the meanings that the words have for the British are part of their style, part of their voice, and you don't want to mess with that a lot. For instance, the expression roll up, they use that for getting in line or queuing up. for a very popular event. And to me, roll up always sounds like everyone is in a wheelchair. So I always try to get them to change that, and sometimes they do and sometimes they don't.
Do you find that when you're confronted with punctuation, because this is another difference. I know that the British use punctuation in some ways very differently than we do. I'm thinking of close quotes at the ends of sentences. We put the period inside the quote, they put the period outside. Mm-hmm. Do you fight with them on that as well?
Well, that's something I've been really surprised to find out that Americans feel passionately about. I knew that was a difference between American and English punctuation. And to me, I don't see what the big deal is. I mean, you can read something in a British publication and see the period after the quote mark, and okay, this is a British publication. But there are Americans who think that we should be doing that too, especially they think if it's in a quote. The British are pretty precise about putting the punctuation inside the quote if that punctuation was inside the quote in the quoted matter. Americans take a little more license, at least the New Yorker takes more license with that. The other thing I've noticed a lot about British writers versus American writers is that they use the semicolon a lot more. They seem to have a better command of the semicolon. And, you know, Americans like muscular language, I think. We like to keep it short. I think of Hemingway. I'm sure Hemingway could use a semicolon if he wanted to, and possibly he has, I just haven't noticed. My bias against the semicolon comes from high school and college when I tried to use it and didn't know how and got big red circles around the semicolons and nobody ever told me what to do. So, you know, what you do is, of course, you have to have a full clause after the semicolon and not just use it as an industrial strength comma.
Yes, and I think that's it, the industrial strength comma. And that brings me to, you spend at least one full chapter here in the book dealing with style. When you have an author that writes in an unorthodox style, what you have to do as a copy editor to make sure that the style is maintained, but yet it's also punctuated correctly as well. And I'm hoping you'll talk a little bit more about that.
I think you're talking about the chapter that has an example from George Saunders in it. A lot of what I do as a copy editor is not change things. I try to keep my hands off things. The author, the writer George Saunders, often writes in the voice of a narrator who is not educated. And the story I'm thinking of is, I'm not even sure how to pronounce it, but it's the Semplica Girl's Diary, where the narrator is keeping a diary. And a narrator, especially of this type, is not going to give all the extra curlicues to words that we do at The New Yorker. And I hesitated. Usually I just barge in and put New Yorker style on words, but George Saunders' editor at The New Yorker will not put his manuscripts through the copy desk. She doesn't want anything happening automatically. So when it comes to the next level, the query proofreader, we have to deal with those matters of style. For instance, I found myself hesitating over whether to change the spelling of catalog in this story, C-A-T-A-L-O-G, to C-A-T-A-L-O-G-U-E. We put the extra French ending on it at The New Yorker. And I ended up ultimately doing that, and George Saunders ended up ultimately accepting that, although it isn't something that his narrator would necessarily have done. Everything else, almost everything else I left alone, you know, numbers we tend to write out at The New Yorker, and things like plus signs we'll write out plus, but this was a guy writing in his diary, and it didn't seem that he'd use anything that fussy. But in the end, I think what happened was that George Saunders realized, too, that you want things to disappear, and a catalog that was spelt differently in The New Yorker than it usually is, that's what would have stopped a regular reader, I think.
You mentioned his editor at The New Yorker. Do you ever find, or have you found in your time at The New Yorker, where you've gone head-to-head with the actual editor of the writer? Has that been an issue, or do you pretty much see eye-to-eye on things?
Well, my job is to back up the editor and the writer. I have this rule where I'll query a thing once, and if they don't take it, I'll query it once more. And if they still don't take it, I will query it one more time, and then I go away. Then that's it. I don't remember ever actually fighting with an editor. Most of my remarks are aimed toward the author, and I'm a bit of a, in that position, I'm a bit of a gadfly. I can say anything I want, and I try to be polite, especially if I know that the editor is going to share my actual proof with the author. That does make a difference. But generally, my remarks to the author are filtered through the editor. Toward the end, in a fact piece, we'll sit down at a table, the author, the editor, the fact checker, and the proofreader, and have a conference, a meeting over the final page proof, go through it a page at a time. That's when I get my answers to why they haven't changed the thing that I've asked for the third time. And the only time I remember getting really angry at a meeting was when somebody wanted to copy the style of a Mad Libs quote, you know, with the underscore and the parentheses and the part of speech. And he wanted to put the part of speech, noun, verb, whatever, in bold face. And the New Yorker does not use a lot of bold face. We like it to look regular and to be easy on the eyes. And I balked about that. I thought it was clear that it was a reference to Mad Libs, and it looked enough like a Mad Libs without the bold face. And he really wanted it to be bold faced, and I muttered, "Well, after the meeting, I could just do whatever I want, huh?" And he did not like that, and he got mad, and so we were both mad. And of course I did what he wanted. I wasn't going to get myself in that kind of trouble by defying the author, so it came out as the way he wanted. And he was very friendly to me after that. I don't know, sometimes you have to have a bit of a blow-up, and then you understand each other, and it's okay from then on.
And then you can work together.
Yes.
We have to talk a little bit about profanity. Because there's a wonderful chapter in the book about profanity and the use of profanity and how one renders profanity in well, specifically in The New Yorker. But can you talk a little bit about that, please?
Well, that's something that has changed a lot since I began to work at The New Yorker under William Shawn, who had some particular phobias. He didn't like for The New Yorker to print any word that meant a bodily fluid, any word at all, you know, spit or blood, these were all. He would just take those out, and you had to work around them somehow. The writer Ian Fraser once wanted to write about fishing, and William Shawn said, "But then you would have to mention hooks." And he didn't like the word, he didn't like references to midgets or wrestlers or twins, which was... that was actually not so odd because he had twins and there was something going on there. And we used to always, well, we could never use plain old four-letter words, the seven words you can never say on radio, and I won't say them. I don't want to ruin everything here. But I was amused to find in our style book a reference to how we would deal with a particular four-letter word, and it was rendered in the style book as hyphen, 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 you. And then the note following that said that we would no longer be using asterisks. It was the asterisk that was banned at that point. And this was gradually, over the years, of course, it became more and more quaint to be doing this. And I've been amused under David Remnick at The New Yorker to find more, as a journalist, I think David Remnick has recognized the need to quote people accurately what they're saying, so we don't change what they're saying. We try, if somebody is just throwing in a four-letter word, to decide whether it's effective or not, whether it actually has meaning, whether it shows that the person being quoted has some character, or whether he's being funny. So we try to judge, make sure it doesn't just mean very, or that he is not just using a four-letter word as a comma, you know, so. But what has happened now, I got ruined by this, by having to close a piece about the rapper Earl Sweatshirt. And we had to quote in every tweet of this rap group exactly as it appeared. And it was all filthy, foul language, and I had to read it over and over again. And it was just like it burnt out my batteries. And I can no longer tell whether or not I should query out a four-letter word, so I just leave them all in there.
And let somebody else do it?
Yeah.
Or not, as it were. Do you find that your job has ruined reading for you in any way? I was thinking about this as I was reading the book, thinking, can she ever read a book and not be doing her job?
When I first started on the copy desk, there was at least a year when I couldn't read for pleasure. It's true. Everything I read, all the typos jumped out at me, and I wanted to mark them and send a letter to the publisher and say, you really ought to fix this. But after a year or so, I was able to read for pleasure again, and I can read for most anything now. I mean, I still prefer to read good writing. I can't read schlock, but I never could, I don't think. But it is a great relief to me that I can read for pleasure. I do still read for pleasure. If I've had a hard week and I've just had that copy up in front of my nose for too many hours in a row, then I might want to watch The Simpsons instead of read. But otherwise, I still take a book with me to bed every night, and I really do enjoy reading as much as ever, if not more.
Mary Norris has been with The New Yorker since 1978, the last 22 years as a query proofreader. Her new book is her first. It's called Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen. She spoke with us recently in front of a capacity crowd at Boswell Book Company.
We'll take one more break, and then a Milwaukee band tries to pick up where surf music left off almost 50 years ago. You are listening to Lake Effect on WUWM.